Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is April 27, 2017, the last show of April. And I'm your host, James Jones. With me today is Guillaume Vaillette.
It is I, Guillaume.
It is you, John Lindemann.
It's just me, myself, and I, James.
That's good, I suppose. And Greg is out watching the Bills make some kind of terrible mistake that will affect their future for the next 5 to 10 years. So we're joined today instead by a former host of this show, Dr. Jonathan Metz.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
You can't do that.
Yes.
I totally endorse it.
Of course you do, John. You've done it before.
Hot tikes. There's a little bit. It's not my best, but.
Oh, my God.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Hi, everybody.
Hi. All right. So we're just going to get right down to it before we de-ingratiate ourselves with Greg any further with new business. And Johnny, I'm going to have you lead off.
Well, Greg doesn't edit the show anymore, so he doesn't really have to listen to this one.
Maybe. But he does.
Yeah, he probably
But he will. Does listen.
He is a fan of the show, as we all are. All right. Well, my first new business in a long time. I haven't been on the show since before Switch came out. I remember maybe it was the January, that late night freak out weirdo live show that we did. Maybe that
It was like 409, 410, somewhere in there.
Or five.
Five, whatever. That's why I don't say the show number at the start.
I always get it wrong. 409 for sure. Anyway, thank you for having me back. I've been playing mostly Zelda since the last time we spoke. I beat Zelda just a couple days ago, so it took me. I took about 2 months to beat it, almost 2 months, and I loved it. I mean, God, it's definitely my favorite Zelda game, and I mean easily one of my favorite games of all time. So I mean, I know I'm not really breaking new ground by saying that kind of stuff, because it's a game that's easy to be superlative about. But you know, for I think people who listen to the show a long time and kind of know a lot about my taste in games should be able to predict how I would feel about this one, because the game is literally about exploring a giant, fascinating, beautiful, mysterious world and looking for all the little treats that the world's designers and artists have left for you to find, and having that kind of moment of surprise and discovery, but also like knowingness that you found something that someone placed for you there and that they challenged you to find it, and you found it and were rewarded for it. I mean, Nintendo as a company is very good at those kinds of experiences, but Zelda is almost that distilled down into its purest form and then exploded out into a million points of detail throughout Hyrule. So I absolutely luxuriated in exploring the world. I took my time beating the game. I really had little interest in defeating Ganon the entire time I played this game. What I cared about was
just there.
I was there to defeat Hyrule, to defeat that map, you know, to defeat the shrines. So I think the shrines are one of the greatest things that ever happened to video games, but certainly to the Zelda series.
Wow.
It's just amazing. I mean, it's the dungeon, but boiled down into its essence, where they can give you the best moments of dungeons. And they made just 120 of them, you know, or maybe let's say about 100. You take out the combat ones, which are kind of disappointing. On that, I'll say they could have made the combat shrines really good. You know, I think it's just the repetition of them. I mean, there are slight variations, but not anything very interesting. And yeah, it's really unfortunate. I feel like with the level design, the arena, the way they put things out, different combinations of enemies, unique enemies maybe would be great to have something that you'll never discover outside those shrines, or to change it up more as you go through. I was surprised that they handled that part the way that they did, because all the other shrines are so thoughtful and fascinating and challenging. A lot of them I found pretty hard, you know, and I struggled against them, and I really resisted going to an FAQ or something. I think I finally did after like many, many dozens of hours playing, because I would get to a shrine and I couldn't figure out how to get into it. And I would spend an hour running around trying things and couldn't figure it out. And I was like, you know what? Life's too short. I'm looking this one up. There's 119 other ones that I can bang my head against. So, you know, but for the most part, I really try to stay away from not spoilers, because the story's whatever to the game, but I try to stay away from puzzle solutions and like in-depth discussion of the systems, exploits, or like tricks to, you know, master the game, basically. I wanted to find my own style of playing the game and my own, you know, my own path through it. So, I mean, my style is really to climb the highest mountain that I can see, look around, tag a bunch of stuff, and then jump off and glide. And I glide a lot. Like, I didn't enjoy running in the game, but also the horses are kind of fun to ride, or at least they're frustrating in a fun, challenging way. But they're just too hard to hang on to, and too, the stables are too spread out too much. So I didn't use horses much, and I tried to minimize my running. So I did that by climbing. I got really good at climbing. I can climb almost any mountain or tower in that game in the rain. I can do it. It's not my preference, but I can do it. And then when you mix that with Revali's Gale, which I wish I had gone to that beast first, but if you have that power, you can mix that in. And you like, I like that it's as limited as it is. Like, it recharges pretty fast, but I like that you have the three uses of the Gale, because if you're climbing up into a mountain range, that those three will not be enough to get you to the top.
So yeah, and also when you solve a puzzle with it, you can't use it cheaply, right? You have to ration it out. You can't just like hop up to the top of something, because some of the puzzles you have to go to like, you have to like go to some pretty tall heights.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the reason they take it away. That's why they take it away in the shrines too, because you could just cheese half the puzzles in the shrines.
Oh yeah,
a lot of my favorite puzzles in Breath of the Wild are climbing on the overworld. It's just, how the hell do you get up there? And there's always a lot of different answers, right? But they're all challenging to some degree and in different ways. So it's really like, that is a puzzle in a way. And, you know, you kind of create your own solution to it based on what's on hand, what you know how to do, what you're good at doing, what you're patient enough for. The climbing is like a really beautiful kind of example of that, because, you know, you have this jump that you can do that like gets you, you know, if you're really impatient, you can just kind of keep jumping up the wall, but it uses more stamina than if you just slowly, methodically went up the same distance. But then that comes into play with climbing in the rain too, by the way. That's the trick, is you kind of have to do the timing. You have to know how long you can climb before you hit the jump, because he'll always,
like, three moves, right?
Yeah, he'll always slip whether you jump or not. So if you climb a little bit and then jump right before he slips, the total amount that you'll go up is greater than the amount that you slip. So if you do that, and if the timing is good enough and enough, it's kind of like bomb jumping in Metroid. If you do it enough times, you can get to places that you otherwise wouldn't be able to get to. And it's not that hard. You just have to practice, you know. And I love that this is a skill-based Zelda game. You know, there's so many things in here that if you find that you're good at this one part, then you can play the game that way. And if you have trouble with it, there's like eight other ways that you can figure out how to do it. And so much of the game is just kind of developing your own cocktail of abilities and items and gear that you want to, you know, that you want to put on and go out and tackle this stuff. And the game is really smart about, you know, throwing different environments, weather effects, level designs, enemies, you know, all these different puzzles, all these different things. It keeps throwing them at you to kind of make you rethink how you can configure Link and yourself to get through it. You know, the fact that it's so good at doing that, it does it so many hundreds of times over the course of this giant game. And there's very little repetition overall, I have to say. You know, there's a few things that I'm like, you know, I wish they had added more enemy types or something like that. But for the most part, I was still being delighted and surprised and challenged by the game even after 105, 110 hours. And, you know, I'll definitely go back to it. But for now, I'm taking a break and basking in my victory.
I will say that, you know, you mentioned you learning and mastering climbing in the rain. And you talked about how, you know, everybody can find their own path through this game. I got really good at finding ways to build fires when it was raining, just to get past the rain, and just wait it out. And like, that shit's hard sometimes because you have to get it in a dry place. And how do you find a dry place on the side of a mountain in a rainstorm? You can do it. There's somewhere in that mountain, there will be a little cliff you can build under.
I feel like you created a challenge for yourself that's actually worse than just climbing in the rain, but
maybe.
or you know, finding some other way. But I mean, but if you like that, I mean, I think the game supports it. That's the thing. I mean, it just all these incredible little emergent things that come out of not just the combat or the puzzle solving, but in everything, just the way that you move around the world, the sequence that you take through the game, the amount, you know, so much of the game being optional, it creates a lot of interesting decisions for the player. I don't think that I've heard enough people talking about this, but you know, the idea that, well, I could run over there or I could use an item that would make it a lot faster, but I have a limited number of these items. So I have to decide what's more important to me, the preparedness of having it in stock and ready in case some emergency goes down, I need to get away, or the convenience and the time saving, which is a very real world benefit of just using my item and getting there faster. And the game has so many different ways of asking you, you know, you kind of end up with this negotiation with yourself of, well, you know, I want to do this, but there's also these other things I want to do. And what's more important to me? What's my priority right now? What do I need or what looks the most fun? What do I think I have time to finish before I have to stop playing and go back to my life? The game is so open-ended that you're just constantly making these decisions and asking yourself, what is it that I want out of this? And what's the best way to get it? And I just think it's masterful. I think the design to create a sandbox like that is mind-boggling to me.
With the Switch being, you know, easy, just suspend and resume, like it almost preys on that instinct even worse because you're like, okay, I can stop this now. I'm not going to, but I could if I wanted to. So I'll try one more thing. And it's a sleep killer. This game, it's just like it's, oh, you were gonna sleep. Well, hey, there's a shiny over there. Yeah. Go look. You want to go deal with it? I mean, you could put it to sleep, and if this takes too long, you can do that. But oh, like playing this on Wii U, Guillaume, I apologize before I finish the sentence. would have been a very different experience, mm-hmm. just because of that one button on the top of the Switch to go. All right, go to sleep.
Yep.
Even if I wasn't using it, you
tap the power button to put it in sleep. I always go to the home menu or just hold it. I hold down the home button.
You could do either.
Huh. I'd be afraid to hit power. Like, I might accidentally just turn it off all the way.
You have to hold it for a while for it to really power down.
Okay. Well, that shows you how often I actually do it, that I don't even really know how to turn it off. Because you can turn it off through the menus. That's what I usually do if I want to power it off. I don't even really know how the whole thing works.
No, I didn't really, like, have a problem saving my game and shutting the console. I think you guys are crazy.
It's not about shutting it down. It's about being able to pick it back up. Yes. It was like four. Like I've got a minute. I can do something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've got a literal minute. I can do a thing right now.
Yeah, it's that portable type gaming on a console kind of thing. It's almost like has like a smartphone quality to it.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Very weird to have that with such a gigantic, massive adventure game like Zelda. You know.
Yep.
That's one thing I kept coming back to is like this game. And that, you know, to talk about the Switch a little bit, the idea that this is, as a Nintendo gamer, in my opinion, it just really doesn't get better than a giant brand new Zelda game that's really long and really rich and dense, and that you can suck. You can just like you can absorb yourself into it, and that's not a fleeting experience. It kind of becomes your life for a while, you know, like a month or two. That is so rare that comes along, and the combination of that combined with the weird convenience and novelty of having it on this little device that I can, you know, if you ever take the Joy-Cons off the Switch and just kind of hold the tablet part of it, it's freaky how small it is. And the idea that the new Zelda, the amazing life-changing new Zelda game is on this slab that I could literally put in my pocket is... It's a cognitive disconnect for me.
Let's put it this way.
I'm still not really used to it.
The screen on the Switch, which is basically the whole size of that little slab, is the same size screen as is on the Wii U. And the Wii U screen doesn't do anything but display what's being beamed to it. And it runs better on that little slab. Mm-hmm. Like that's the mental breakdown that I had with this thing. I'm like, what? Yeah. What are you?
The technology is seriously impressive in a way that I don't know that Nintendo's getting enough credit for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
Or Nvidia.
It's an interesting game for me because it reminds me almost of like Grand Theft Auto V. I mean, Grand Theft Auto V, it still sells to this day. It's still one of the top 10 games every single month. I don't know how. I don't know why. But it reminds me of Grand Theft Auto V because you can play through Grand Theft Auto V, and that's cool. And yeah, it has an online component, but like that aside, you can still, like once you beat the game, there's still a whole bunch of stuff that you can do and accomplish. And then even beyond that, there's this sandbox element that keeps the game going for years, where people just try to do the wackiest shit they possibly can and put it on YouTube. And I feel like that's exactly what Breath of the Wild is going to be like. Like, people will just be trying to do crazy stuff for, like, years going forward.
Well,
speedrunning, all that kind of stuff.
Not only that, John, but think about just how small the potential audience for Zelda is right now. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got the Wii U ownership, a large portion of whom have not been buying Wii U games for a long time.
For years.
Right? So they're not necessarily going to come out of the woodwork and go buy Zelda. But even then, even if every single person who owned a Wii U bought Zelda, it wouldn't be that many people. And then you've got the Switch, which is brand new, and there's only like a million of them in the world right now. So the actual number of people playing Zelda, even though it sold like, you know, over a million copies, mm-hmm. compared to like the number of people who bought Horizon Zero Dawn a couple months ago, it's still not even caught up with that just because of the systems that it's available on. So assuming the Switch continues to be a hit, and I think it probably will be. I mean, it deserves to be. It has one of the greatest games ever as a launch title, so that alone will carry it through for a long time. People are going to be discovering Zelda on a consistent basis for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Because right, if you buy a Switch, it is the game you're probably going to get for it. And there's a whole lot of people who don't currently own a system that can play Zelda. And they're going to be picking it up over the years to come. So, and they're going to be blown away by it. It's going to be like, have you guys played this? And we'll be like, yeah, man, back in 2017. But I mean, it really, it's that good of a game that it's going to have that effect on people.
That's pretty funny because today on Twitter, I kind of unloaded my soul about the Switch. Like, I was like, you know, now that Zelda has come and gone, I'm not that hyped about getting a Switch, and I think that playing it in the Wii U has kind of deprived me of the Switch killer app. And as a result, like, I'm looking at the release list, and mostly what I see is, you know, ports of indie games that I could be playing on the PC. And, you know, like, I love those games, but it's not exciting, you know? And I look at Mario Kart 8 and I'm like, I've played this. This is not exciting either. Like, I'm more interested in like freaking Forza Horizon 3, like the Hot Wheels pack, than I am for Mario Kart 8 Redux.
Yeah, we're still in the launch window.
I know, so I know, but
yeah, you know, I mean, Zelda was the real reason to be there at launch for Switch, for
right.
sure.
If Zelda didn't push you into buying a Switch right off the bat, assuming you had the means to do it, you know, obviously not everybody does, but assuming that you could have bought a Switch and Zelda wasn't going to convince you, nothing for the next 6 or 8 months is likely to do it either, you know, because mm-hmm. if you wanted to buy a Switch for Splatoon 2, you probably would have just gone ahead and done it so you could play Zelda on it too, right?
Right.
So,
I mean, if you could.
I mean, I think Mario will convert a lot of people, but the thing is, not that many. I mean, we don't actually still really know shit about Mario, and even though we've seen that trailer, I'm not convinced that the wider mass of people who might be interested in a new Mario game have seen the trailer. So, Mario, I think, will convert a lot of people at the end of this year, and also the marketing blitz over Zelda.
So,
because
I think you're underselling the power of the Mario Kart. Because remember what Mario Kart 8 did for the Wii U. It actually had its first real positive sales month when that game came out. I mean, so to put some numbers around what you were postulating.
Although that was a new Mario Kart.
Yeah, so. But Nintendo only sold about...
Not quite the same situation here.
Nintendo only
first
sold about 14 million Wii Us. Lifetime. So a lot of people who would be interested in Mario Kart said, uh-uh. To the Wii U.
Yeah.
But people who were saying no to Wii U for a long time, Mario Kart broke them. I suspect there's a group somewhere in there that's willing to make that jump, especially considering the reviews Mario Kart's getting. But to give some numbers to what we talked about.
Yeah.
So Nintendo sold 3.84 million copies of Zelda in March. So just through the end of their fiscal year. 2.76 million of that was on Switch.
Wow.
Which means just over a million of that was on Wii U. That 2.76 is impressive, but it's more impressive when you realize I sold 2.74 million Switches. So, like, Zelda's attach rate is absurd.
Yep.
But, like, that's 100% sell-through rate on the console. And they're still there. And we're 2 months in. The Wii U is not at 100% sell-through at 2 months. Because I infamously, on this show, walked into Target an hour before recording and just bought one. And then went on the show. I feel bad because I did it.
It is effectively sold out in the sense that you can't just go to any store and get one, right? So some stores get them and they have them for a certain amount of time. Like Amazon, I think there were some today and then they were gone, you know? So yeah. Like it's not readily available, which is not to say it's impossible to get, but you kind of have to be on the spot when they show up.
And I would guess Amazon held stock for Mario Kart because that's what a lot of retailers are doing.
Yeah.
Like Target has a stock for Mario Kart.
Yeah. But I mean, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe is honestly coming out too early in the system lifespan, which I think is okay, assuming that they're going to make another Mario Kart for the Switch or an equivalent product, you know.
Or a DLC not, pack.
Yeah, I'm more of the mind to just DLC, keep making more stuff for it.
That'd be perfectly fine with me if it just became Mario Kart Infinity. But yeah, that'd be great. But
here's the ARMS DLC pack for Mario Kart. You could drive on the ARMS.
Yeah, like, but I mean, Switch is just not there's not enough Switch hardware available to buy for Mario Kart to drive a huge sales bump.
No, it's getting that game out there so they can try to drive that thing to as high attach rate as possible lifetime.
Forgive the pun, but it is kind of a sidecar to Zelda at this point.
Sure. As a sidebar to that, since you guys probably haven't seen it.
As a sidebar to my sidecar joke.
Yeah. Nintendo just announced the 2DS XL because, I don't know, reasons?
What?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't see that.
Let's get some hot takes, James. Let's throw some pictures.
It looks hot as shit is the hot take. Hold on. I'm gonna get you the picture of the Japan only color because this is upsetting.
Ooh.
This is the one I have handy.
I'm pretty excited.
Is that spicy orange?
Yeah. Ooh, look at that.
Wait, ooh. This is a 2DS, so it still has a hinge.
It's a 2DS. 2DS XL.
It's a 2D. Okay.
I'm
interesting.
Upset.
Oh, this is wild. So it looks like a 3DS XL.
Sleeker. Like a little bit sleeker.
It's a little bit sleeker. I don't know. It does have kind of an iMac or a...
It's very rounded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got that iMac. Concave look to it.
Yeah, two-tone.
So does that mean this will be like the first 3DS that doesn't streak? Like, I'd be very upset with that because it's the only also...
It looks really recessed on the top screen.
Yeah, yeah. So it looks like the first well-designed 3DS, and that makes me really upset because it's a 2DS, and I like the 3D.
Yeah, it looks like the DS Lite a little bit.
Freaking hell.
This is weird.
But it's not. It's an XL. It's big.
Yep.
Oh, this is amazing.
It's
$150.
Neat.
It's half the price of a Switch.
Okay. All right.
I'm just
curious what kind of screens this thing has on it. Because if these are like really nice quality screens that are, you know, like kind of clearer, better lit than the other 3DS screens, then this could end up being kind of a archival version of the hardware, you know, like one to keep around that'll work forever because it's basically new when you...
Like the GBA Micro.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. But
this is not a new 2DS XL, right?
What?
Well, this they're not is not calling a new, it that, I guess.
It's not a new 2DS XL, right? It doesn't have the extra processing power.
Ooh, good question.
It's got to be a new because it's got the C-Stick.
Oh, right.
That's true.
Okay.
That's true. Yeah. So, okay.
I mean, It has Amiibo built in. It's new.
2DS XL, effectively. Yeah. They may not call it that, but weird. Okay.
So they comes out in July. So you could play all the Super NES games on this, which would probably be pretty damn cool.
That's true.
Yeah.
On this big ass screen. I wonder if it might be better for them.
I don't know.
I wonder if the top screen, or I wonder if the screens in general are larger or the same size than the new 3DS XL, which is what I've got. I wonder if it's like an even larger version of it.
I don't think they've emailed out the PR yet.
Because I'd be down with that.
It comes out along games like Hey Pikmin.
Yeah. Whoa. Hey Pikmin could not be less interested in that, really.
But no, that's their timing.
Yeah, it's too bad. Anyway, to get back.
Thanks to Seren for sidetracking us. Yeah, well, she's not even on the show.
That's the newest business there is.
There we go.
That is interesting. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense that Nintendo's trying to milk the 3DS because it's got a big, giant library. A lot of people still never owned one, and maybe this is the kind of thing that'd be like, yeah, maybe I'll finally pick one up. The Switch still costs too much or something like that. But I think the Switch as a handheld has been surprisingly good for my I have limited usage. I'm not a big handheld gamer, honestly. Most of my 3DS play was in my apartment laying on the couch. But I did travel recently with my Switch. I'm going to be doing it again this weekend. I'm in an unusual situation, kind of like what John talked about on the last episode when he came to visit me. My girlfriend back in Texas has a Switch. And thus a dock. So, and I'm going on these, you know, very short 2-day weekend trips to go visit her and vice versa. And we don't have to carry cables with us. So
that's true. You just drop in each other's docks.
Yeah. So I took my Switch to back to Austin the first time that I went to visit her. And it was a very weird feeling to pack for that trip. Cause I'm like, I feel like there's not enough stuff here for me to take video games with me. I mean, it's traveling with a Switch, honestly, is now for me lighter than traveling with a 3DS. Because with a 3DS, I definitely got to take a charger. The Switch, I actually really don't, because it's a 2.5-3 hour flight back there. So the battery lasts for the whole flight. I can even take my Pro Controller with me and just play on the plane. And I did this. I set up the Switch on the tray in the plane. And then busted out my Pro Controller and didn't bring a cable for that either. I mean, that battery on that thing lasts forever. But it was all like very, you know, lean and streamlined kind of travel experience. It was great. I got to play Zelda for hours and hours, you know. It was wonderful. It was actually really fun to show my girlfriend where I was and get to see where she was. And also just to watch each other play the game. Because, again, you end up having these very different personal interests in what part of the game you're interested in doing, and also just a very different style of play. So I found out that she cooks a ton in that game. It always has this giant...
She's the best.
Yeah.
I agree.
Has the suitcase full of foods, probably more than she will ever need to finish the game, whereas I rarely have more than a useless fire elixir in my inventory. I just kind of scrape by most of the time. but anyway, so it was really fun to travel with the Switch. And I told John about this. I had a very awkward accidental mandate in the airport where I saw this guy. I was just grabbing a quick burger or something before my flight. I sat down and I just ordered, and I look across, and this guy at the table next to me is like decked out in Nintendo jackets and shoes and backpack and everything. And I'm like, wow, okay. I just stuck the Switch in my backpack. It's back there. It's got Zelda on it. I gotta ask him if he's tried it. Cause if he hasn't, he should try it. You know, it just came out. There's not that many of them out there. So I asked the guy, weirdly, he didn't even really seem to know anything about it. I think he was more into Nintendo the style than Nintendo the video game company.
Oh boy.
Posers, they get no props on RFN.
You know, I'm not saying that. I mean, in talking with a guy,
John is.
So I did awkwardly introduce myself and offer to let him play Zelda on the Switch, which he was pretty excited to do. And yeah, he was checking it out and asking questions. And yeah, I mean, he's played a lot of Nintendo games, so it's not like that. But it was a good reminder, actually, that not everybody stays up on the news, on the video. Like, if it's not being talked about.
You were his Sherpa.
I guess.
It's true.
Yeah.
He will never forget you.
If it's, you know, a lot of people don't even watch TV anymore, really. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if you watch Netflix or something, if you mainly watch TV on Netflix, how would you even know that a Switch exists? You're not seeing the TV commercials. You're not seeing it on Jimmy Fallon, et cetera, et cetera. If you're not listening to gaming podcasts and going to, you know, Giant Bomb or IGN or Nintendo World Report, maybe you don't even know anything about the Switch. Maybe you heard about it, but you never got around to looking it up. Or, you know, I was surprised that even people who like Nintendo don't necessarily know shit about this big new product and their best new Zelda game. So if you got one, share it, is what I'm saying. It was kind of cool to talk to this guy and get that perspective. But anyway, I was very, very happy with Switch. And again, I'm really big on the Pro Controller. I think the Joy-Cons are fine in a pinch when absolutely necessary. I wish they were like twice as big, honestly. But the Pro Controller is great. I'm super happy with it. And I've played the vast majority of Zelda and everything else on the Switch. I've played on the Pro Controller. So again, the fact that it's wireless and has a really long battery life means I can just throw it in my bag for the entire trip and don't even really have to worry about charging it or anything. Or if I did, it's still USB, you know.
It is, yeah. And we made jokes about the battery add-ons for the Joy-Cons because of how completely absurd they are. Mm. But I mean, if you want them bigger, I guess. There you go. There's your option.
I mean, that definitely caught my eye for that reason. But I just don't know that I would use the Joy-Cons enough to make it worth trying to upgrade them in that way. More interested to see if they do a GameCube controller or something. But I'll just talk about another game I've been playing. John mentioned, was it Graceful Explosion Machine last week? Is that the title?
Yep.
Anyway, I played a bunch of that, played more of it since I was hanging out with you, John, and at this point I've almost beaten all the levels. I like it more than I did at first. I learned more. There's more depth to the weapons and the way that you use them and the way the energy is balanced out, so I started to appreciate it more for that, but I do think the weapon energy, especially for your main simple straightforward machine gun, I think it's kind of broken in a against the player. I think that thing's too hard to use and it's too confusing how it mixes with the other weapons because it has its own meter. I'm not crazy about the level designs or the graphics in that game, but it's pretty engaging. If you're into like arcade shooters, I think it's pretty good. And the different weapons are very interesting in the way that they can be useful in different situations. It's not an amazing game. I mean, it's not as good as I was hoping for based on the very strong reviews for it. You know, I think it's a nice thing to have on the Switch just because the arcade kind of game that you can totally get sucked into on the TV, but also it'd be great to just pick up and play one level on the go or something like that. But, against the giants of this, you know, 2D shoot 'em up arcade style genre like Geometry Wars and Resogun, it doesn't hold a candle. I mean, especially Resogun is very similar game that came out 3-4 years earlier and still looks way better than Graceful Explosion Machine. And also just plays better. It's just better designed game. So it's tough for me because I have access to much better versions of the same thing. It doesn't differentiate itself enough for my taste. But I do think it's a quality game and, you know, I've put maybe 10 hours into it. So I'm fairly satisfied. A better Switch game that I can very strongly recommend is Blaster Master Zero. You know, my last episode as host of Radio Free Nintendo, we talked about Blaster Master. And I got mad love for that game. So I was pretty excited about Inti Creates making a new one for the 3DS and especially on the Switch. It was almost a launch title for Switch. And it's really good. You know, the title might suggest to you that it is the same kind of project as Metroid Zero Mission, and that is the case. So if you're kind of wondering, is it a remake? Is it a sequel? Is it like how much of it is new versus how much of it is like the old maps and stuff and the old bosses? It's about like Metroid Zero Mission. So it contains pretty much all of the content from the original Blaster Master, but it's all been redone, so it looks way better, it controls better, the menus and the systems and all that stuff are improved to make it feel kind of like more like a modern game, and they just kind of really cleaned it up and added save points and things like that. But then probably about, I don't know, somewhere between like one third and one half of the game is completely new content. So on the old maps, they added new caves and extra like permanent life upgrades and things like that. You know, like new power-ups, new abilities that you can get, new sub-weapons. You can go dig out of caves and stuff. So they added lots more stuff to kind of densify the world. And then they also expanded some of the maps to add new places, new bosses. There's my favorite part. There's a couple of bosses that are in the overworld, so you actually fight them in the tank. And they're really fun, and they look amazing. So I wish there was more of that kind of stuff, but it is pretty cool when you get to it. And then the overhead stuff is still definitely a big part of the game. I know it's the part everybody hates about the original Blaster Master. I always kind of love the jankiness of it and the way you almost have to exploit it to even get through it. This one is obviously less reliant on exploits and things like that, but it's pretty hard. It's very faithful in the overall kind of the kind of action that you're doing. You're walking around overhead and shooting enemies, and it's all about kind of lining up and angles and things like that. And you still lose weapon power-ups when you get hit, which is pretty brutal. But this game, they add quite a few. So the pickups are much more common. You can get a shield that lets you absorb one or two hits before you lose gun upgrades, and then it recharges. So in a lot of cases, you can get hit and kind of fudge it a little bit, and you still can keep the really good weapons. And the really good weapons are insanely powerful. So if you can upgrade to those and kind of play somewhat conservatively and, you know, and not get hit too much, you can blast through those places. So I think the overall, on the whole, they're easier and more fun than before. You can play them with a joystick now, which is great because it makes diagonal aiming way easier, and you can really take advantage of that against a lot of the enemies. So Blaster Master Zero is really good, and I'm very, very satisfied by it. I'm almost through it now. I'm at the very end. I'm now driving through corridors that are made of brains. So you know I'm close to the end, and it's great.
As you do at the end of all games.
Well, sometimes it's not a brain. Sometimes it's just ripping off H.R. Geiger.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's just video games.
And sometimes it's not a video game. It's the game of life.
Right.
We're gonna hard shift. John, what have you been playing?
Everything seems to be coming back to Johnny and I's, you know,
magical trip. Weekend getaway.
Yeah. Rendezvous, I think.
Oh, no.
That's no. A word that Guillaume will be very familiar with.
What? No.
Because it's in French? Probably means something different in French. Like, everything sounds salacious to you, guy, just because it's French, but it's just a fucking meeting in French.
Funnily enough, Guillaume, you're sexy. Not wrong. In this case, they've sexed up the word for meeting.
Hey, guys, what's up with Bonhomme?
But you gotta watch him. That guy'll get you.
It's a classic.
I've lost control. Okay.
John, talk about it. All right, so
talk about the 8-year-old RPG, please.
Yes. So Johnny, he recently beat The Witcher 3, right? So I went back and
this is true. You can do amazing things when you're unemployed for several months.
Yes.
You can climb a lot of mountains, figuratively speaking.
Yeah. So I went back and played Witcher 2, which was free on Xbox Live Gold a while back last year sometime. So I downloaded it and I was just curious about it, you know, because I'd played Witcher 3 up to a point, kind of abandoned it, but I was just curious. I plan on going back to it at some point. So I was like, yeah, let's just have a look at Witcher 2. And of course, you know, it plays on Xbox One with Xbox 360 backwards compatibility. So it's very easy to just boot it up and start playing, right? So it's not the longest game. It's actually shorter than I thought it would be. I think it probably took me maybe about 30 hours to beat. It's not.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's not long at all.
That's tempting, because Witcher 3 is an undertaking. I stuck to the main story, and it still took me about 80 or 90 hours, I think, to beat The Witcher 3.
Yeah, Witcher 2 is very self-contained. Okay. But you know, I like coming back. The thing is with Witcher 3, I will say my first experience with that game, overwhelming. Completely overwhelming. There is so much stuff to learn, so much stuff to grasp. And the way Witcher, I'm really glad that I played through Witcher 2. I played it through all the way to the end and I beat it. Which shows you something. It shows you right there that it's not that long a game because I can actually do that with it. I was playing it just to gauge Johnny. I was playing it probably over the course of 2 weeks. And, you know, so you had a couple of weekends in there where I threw some considerable time at it. And then there was, you know, a couple of, you know, weeknights there where, you know, like maybe I played 3 weeknights out of the week. So just to give you an example, I don't really know exactly how long it took me, but I would say probably somewhere between 30, 35 hours roughly. So,
okay.
And it's actually really nice coming back to Witcher 3 now, because what Witcher 2 does is it kind of has a lot of this stuff in place, like it has the crafting and like the battle styles and kind of like the way you build your character is similar. It's similar, but you can see with Witcher 3, they just threw a whole bunch more stuff on it. So Witcher 2, you know, and it has the same kind of, you know, branching character stuff, you know, where you'll come to a point in the plot where you can choose, you make a major choice, right? You know, should you kill this person or should you let them live? Should you side with this person or that person? So it has that replayability factor. And I think with Witcher 2, that's actually useful. Whereas with Witcher 3, that game is so massive.
Who's gonna play that game twice?
I mean, I don't know
how long
it takes.
Most people never get through it the first time. Let's be honest.
Like, how long do you think it took you to beat Witcher 3? Because I have a guess. My guess would be over 100 hours.
I played about 100 hours.
Yeah,
that was over the course of maybe a month. And through that month, I played that game like it was my job.
Yeah.
Because I could. Because I didn't have a job.
Yeah.
But I was often playing more than 8 or 10 hours a day.
Yep. And that is exactly what I would expect. I mean, it is that kind of game where I play it. And, well, I mean, with Witcher 3, you effectively go, it kind of tells a story about how, you know, Geralt, he has to, you know, it's, you know, people are killing kings. And so he has to kind of figure that out. And he has to sort of clear his name. And it almost feels like, what I like about the Witcher games is that you can tell there's a huge, you know, backstory kind of lore behind those games. And Witcher 2 almost feels like kind of a side story, like sort of like Geralt kind of like getting drawn into this sort of web of intrigue because he has certain kind of things that he's trying to figure out as a character. Like kind of like the main thrust of his kind of, you know, like what he's trying to accomplish and, you know, what is life about? That kind of stuff, you know, that kind of existential crisis stuff that he's trying to figure out. But this is almost kind of like a, you know, almost like a side story, it feels like, where he gets like drawn into this. He gets something, like, he gets a crime pinned on him, and then it's about him extricating himself from that kind of stuff and figuring out why it happened and what the goals of the people were that, you know, that were doing these things and all that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, what I like about coming into Witcher 3 now, which I recently picked back up again, and I'll beat it at some point, is that it's prepared me a lot better for Witcher 3. Like I can transfer what I know from Witcher 2 in terms of what's important. I mean, when I first started playing Witcher 3, what's a trophy? What are all these oils I can make? I can make potions, but what do I want to use them for? How useful are they? Because in some games, you can make potions, but it doesn't really matter. You know, what should I do with all of these crafting diagrams? And there's just a whole bunch of stuff. And I mean, in Witcher 2, there is no Gwent card game to learn, right? So that in and of itself, to me, I took the time to actually learn it, so I'm okay at it now. But that in itself is intimidating. In Witcher 2, it's really simple and fun because there's three main cities that are the big quest hubs. And in each city, instead of having like the Gwent card game stuff and the fighting, there's fighting still, but you can also do arm wrestling, which I don't think is in Witcher 3. I don't remember that. Maybe it's still in there. But you have kind of the, oh, well, you know, you beat these four guys in this town and you get some piece of armor or money or something like that. So it just feels like this stuff in Witcher 3, it feels like more, it's a more conventional RPG and it doesn't throw the open world stuff that I find really complicates stuff in Witcher 3. I mean, you have so much stuff that you can do. I mean, Witcher 3 is you just strap yourself in for a long time. You're going to be playing that game for a while because you can sit there and you can spend, I mean, in the first village, which doesn't even have anything in it, you can spend 20 hours in that village just doing side quests.
It wouldn't be that much fun, I think, but you probably could. Yeah. But yeah, though, the Witcher 3 in a lot of ways was good training for Zelda just to turn it back around because, yeah, it did kind of make me pay attention to what I wanted to get out of the game and make myself focus on that. Or if I was in the mood to not focus on anything, I would kind of take that approach to it and the game would support that. But like that game can get away from you. You know, and you can very easily spend a lot of time in The Witcher 3 doing stuff that's, I mean, certainly will not help you reach the end of the story, which at some point you're probably going to care about because the writing and the acting is amazing. You know, you can do a lot of stuff that will not really help you develop your character, which you might care about, right? Or not really help you explore the world. You could just spend, you can pour a lot of time into stuff that's, in my opinion, pretty meaningless, but maybe to other people, they would find that stuff very rich and rewarding. So you kind of just have to be honest with yourself when you play such a large game like that and just be willing to make decisions like, you know what? Okay, I tried Gwent. I might have played one game of Gwent. I can't even remember, to tell you the truth. It would have been so early in The Witcher 3 that like I was still like you said, just totally overwhelmed by everything and not even like really sure what was happening. Because that game is just systems upon systems upon systems. But you know, I just decided, you know, 3, I obviously don't need to play Gwent to get through this, and it's already such a long game. I'm just going to decide not to play Gwent. Because I ain't got time for that shit.
If you want, you can go nuts and try to collect every Gwent card in the game. You can do stuff like that. Much like Breath of the Wild, where you, if you want to collect every single Korok seed in the game, by God, have at it. You can do it.
I did collect all the cards in Final Fantasy VIII, but that was another time. And that game's not it's not nearly as expansive as either Zelda or The Witcher 3. So.
And the cards glow. they're just there.
But you have to play against every character, including the main villain of the game. Because you have to win their cards, then they have the most powerful cards.
So in the interest of time, not to rush you, John, but one thing that I'm picking up here is you're both cautioning me in code, James, don't touch Witcher 3.
It is a Xenoblade Chronicles X endeavor. It's that scale.
Oh, where God.
You're going to be there
you're basically,
for...
You're basically telling me it's going to prey on my worst weaknesses.
I would say The Witcher 3 is a bigger game in a lot of ways. I mean, it's more dense, I think, especially with story.
You can certainly do more. It's less straightforward. I mean, you can just walk, and you might find a cave and spend 2 hours in it and kill some monster that's really cool. And then you'll come out and you'll be like, oh, I haven't done anything in this game. I haven't progressed at all, but I've sat here and I've spent 3 or 4 hours just kind of dicking around. It's that type of game.
Yeah.
So and it's now amazingly well executed. That game is awesome. But just prepare for it to be the main game you're playing for a while.
Yeah, you have to have a lot of self-control or you will be punished for the lack thereof.
I also found, Johnny, Witcher 2 is a heck of a lot easier to get into than Witcher 3. Witcher, because it's so much more conventional, you know? Yeah. Like, you start off and it's you're tossed right into the story, whereas in Witcher 3, you're just kind of like, you're out in this meadow kind of thing, and, you know, there's a horse over there, and you'll get attacked by some stuff, and, go to a village and figure some shit out. Like, that's kind of Witcher 3. It's sort of like, I thought the beginning of Witcher 3 was kind of boring, because it's just so open-ended. And you're not really sure what to do, and the first part of the game isn't really that engaging. You're just kind of like out in the countryside, and you're sort of like, all right, what am I really doing here? Like, it seems like I'm tracking somebody, but I could also go over here and help this dude do something. And there's also what I like too, after playing Witcher 2, is that there's a lot of in jokes in Witcher 3 that go back to characters that you encountered in Witcher 2. So I would say Witcher 2. I mean, I think with all your experience with Witcher 3, you would just blow through Witcher 2 because it's much simpler. Yeah. And also, there's not as much emphasis on crafting. Like, you can still craft stuff, but it's not absolutely critical to the end game.
So do you think the story is worth the 30 hours or whatever that you put into it?
I think so. It's cool because it fills you in a lot on events that kind of come into Witcher 3.
Okay.
So it fleshes out the characters to a certain degree. It's cool. It's cool. And it goes into Geralt's past a bit, so it's good. Okay. But I highly recommend it. I mean, really, like, I really enjoyed it. I mean, when I was done playing it, I was like, wow, that was an amazing game. So I'm really glad I played through it. I just took a chance on it. So, but yeah, now on to Witcher 3, and we'll see how that goes. I think I'm going to enjoy it more than I did the first time around.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because I just restarted. Nice. I said, you know what? I'm just going to start fresh with a totally new perspective on the game. So,
cool. Guillaume.
Yeah, well, this will be short. I've been playing mostly Persona 5, and I'm just, I'm just starting to like it more than I have been.
I did tell you it's going to take some time.
It really seems like people are trying very hard to like Persona 5. That's my view, it takes
a while to get going.
Anyway, I didn't want to get too much into it. I just wanted to say, like, I've been mostly playing that. But I did manage to play a little bit of Towerfall on the PC. And this game is like came out in 2013. Mostly I heard about it from Neil, Nintendo World's Report's own Neil, who kept saying stuff like, oh, Towerfall is so amazing. It makes, like, the PS4 is the premier multiplayer platform right now. And I was just like, shut up, Neil. Nintendo Land is fun. But I got to admit, like, Towerfall is pretty cool. And it reminds me a lot, and I should have looked this up before, but long ago on this podcast, I mentioned this homebrew Wii game called Super Mario War. And actually, it's not Wii U homebrew. Like, I mean, there's a port in the Wii U homebrew channel, but you can play this on your PC. And it's just, it takes different sprites from Super Mario games, and it puts you in a one-screen arena, and most of the levels kind of wrap around not just left, you know, left and right, like on the sides, but also if you fall in the hole, you appear back from the ceiling.
Yeah, and like so bubble you can bobble. Right,
so you can surprise your opponents. It's a multiplayer game. You can surprise your opponents by you can attack them by you know, jumping on their heads, and so you can surprise them by jumping into a hole, appearing from the ceiling, and you know, like, you can do a lot of devious stuff. So that's Super Mario Wars, and Towerfall is very much the same thing. The screen wraps around. You can attack. You've got a crossbow which can shoot. You've got a very limited number of arrows. You have to pick them back up from, you know, on the ground or the walls if you want to reuse those arrows. But you can also jump on the heads of your opponents.
That's
Yeah, it feels really good. The controls are really, like, you know, they're Mario controls. You can steer your guy in midair. You can probably, like, become a really expert player at this game and have a lot of fun in it. But mostly, it's a co-op game, so that's how I've been playing it with Karen. So two players, there's enemies that keep appearing, and you just, like, defeat wave after wave of enemy until, you know, the final wave or a boss. And then you can move on to the next screen. And then the levels themselves, you know, they're all one screen. They're not all... There's a lot of kind of repetition thematically. You look at the same tiles a whole lot. So it's not maybe the most exciting. But eventually, like, you get far enough into the game and you uncover the usual, like, ice world where it's slippery and stuff like that. So I'm very, very early, very, very early into this game. And so I'm looking forward to discovering more of it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I love Towerfall. I played a bunch of it on the PS4. And I played some of the co-op too, which I really enjoyed. I mean, I don't think that's, like, the main part of the game. There's not really a single player or even a co-op campaign. It's more like a just a series of enemy challenges with different combinations of enemies. But the enemies are pretty tough and aggressive, and sometimes they put a lot of them on the screen, which is really, because of the nature of the game, it makes it really difficult to avoid them all because your character just kind of darts around in a not a haphazard way, but like it's the game's so fast that it's very easy to just kind of careen into an enemy when you're looking at another one, you know.
Yeah, and it's very easy because, you know, like, this is a game B type of thing in Double Dragon terms. Like, you can't hit each other, so it's kind of dangerous. And also, like, the enemies have kind of very varied patterns. Sometimes you'll have to distract them. Like, there are ghosts that if you try to shoot them with your crossbow, the arrow is going to go through them. But while they're in that... while they're kind of phased out, you can jump on their heads. So you have to do various things to various enemies to be able to even damage them. Some enemies will actually kind of grab your arrows in midair and shoot them back at you. Some enemies will explode, like send shrapnel in certain directions when you kill them. And so you got to be careful not to kill yourself, but also not to kill your partners. Mm-hmm. So... it's, you know, it's a very simple game. It's basically two button control, but it's not easy. But the thing with like simple but tough games is that even though they're hard, most people can play them. You know, like this is a game that I can play with Karen. Like she doesn't like when you have to control a camera in 3D space. She doesn't like when there's too many button combinations to remember, but you know, a kind of a very like simple but effective controls like this, like she takes up to them really quickly, and I think that's the case for most people who, you know, grew up playing like the NES or the Genesis, and then kind of once the Super Nintendo hit, kind of just abandoned gaming.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
I'm very excited.
It's a great fit for Switch because. I mean, Towerfall is, in my mind, mostly a multiplayer game, and especially the versus, the deathmatch in that game is, it's pretty close to a 2D, like a retro 2D Smash Brothers. I mean, it's very fast, it's very competitive, there's a lot of skill to it. It's easy to learn, but it's very hard to master, and the three and four player is absolutely crazy. I mean, I think it's really key also that when you die, it's not aggravating, it's funny, because you'll die a lot and it's okay, and it's actually fun to die in the game, which makes it a lot more accessible for people who don't play games as much or who aren't as confident in their skills, because you don't feel punished when you don't do well. And I think it's a perfect fit for the Switch. Even in two player, you can play almost the entire game two player, whether versus or co-op. So having that on the go with the built-in Joy-Cons is, like you said, it's basically a two-button game. So it's really, really well-suited for the platform. That's going to be great.
Yeah, between this and Overcooked, like I think the Switch is going to be really like a multiplayer platform of choice.
Definitely.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And that's basically what I've been playing.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up because I, too, have been playing a tremendous amount of Persona 5. I'm at, like, 68 hours or so.
Wow.
And according to Seren, I'm not actually as close to the end as I thought I was. So that's actually
turns out there's, like, an inverted castle or something.
It's like 100 hours coming up, James.
That's, like, kind of disheartening. I was like, all right, I'm getting there. I'm ready to move on to the next game. And she's like, why are you plotting your next game? No. you're not where you think you are. And I went, here we go.
Look, like these games, they end when they end for you. You know, like the Shin Megami Tensei, like you can spend a lot of time in Shin Megami Tensei 4 trying to get to the best ending, which I'm sure is the only thing that Seren considers actually finishing the game. but you could also save yourself.
You can't defend yourself, so say what you're thinking, Guillaume.
you could also save yourself 20 hours not doing kind of tedious bullshit. No. And finish the game.
Look, I think it's fair to say that Seren is a hardcore gamer. Maybe
no, this is
hardcore for this gang.
This is a situation where I realize that there are more dungeons than I thought there were.
Yeah.
Okay. This isn't like some like get the secret ending crap.
So you say you can't handle it, James? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm fine.
I suggest you do the same thing I did with Bravely Default and the first kind of fake ending that the game gives you. Just take it.
Yeah.
Just like,
just didn't give me one.
But James, just remember, you can do better.
Can I, John? Because I'm on this show right now. Can I really do better?
I would say yes. It's a resounding yes.
Anyway, you fucks. So I've been playing.
By the way, I do feel like all the Persona 5 talk is not wasted on this show, because it seems very likely that will come out on Switch eventually. Am I crazy thinking that? I mean,
I'm willing to bet there's money to make sure that doesn't happen, actually.
Huh. Okay.
But anyway, I actually have been playing something that did come out on Switch just today, actually. Kamiko, which is a top-down action Zelda-inspired pixelized game that came out of Japan, released about a month ago in Japan. It just now finally made its way to the West, thanks to I'm blanking on who published it. Circle. Mm-hmm. This is from, I'm blanking on the name of the company, but the person who made this game, I say person because that's what it is, made a bunch of 3DS eShop games. Faerun. Yeah.
I played the first one. It was pretty good. It was like kind of a perfectly, like a bite-sized kind of Zelda-y, Game Boy Zelda-y experience, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, guess what, Guillaume? You just described Kamiko.
Nice.
This is a very short game. It's about four zones. You're dropped in it, and you have to kill enemies and solve puzzles around the map. So, like, you go to one place, and you get the key, and you carry it to another door. But to be able to get to that door while you're carrying the key, because your hands are full, you have to trip some switches and move some stuff around before you try to take the key there. So it's a lot of just learning the map that you're being dropped in, learning where things are and where you need to take them, solving some of those little puzzles, and just getting around the game world efficiently and basically getting to these little beacons that you have to open up in order to proceed to the next level. And then you fight a boss, and then you get to essentially a series of those. I was clearing them at about each stage in about 11 to 19 minutes. So like I said, it's a pretty brisk game. And to sort of make up for its briskness, you get three characters with different weapon styles. So,
playability.
Yeah, I was using the sword character. There's apparently one that has a lance, and then there's one that throws a boomerang. There's a very like Japanese art style layered on top of it, but then re-rendered in pixels. It's a kind of a neat looking game. It plays well. The combat is very Zelda inspired, but there's button combos. So like, there's only one attack button, but it's got combos. So it's, you know, attack, 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 and then the fourth attack causes some kind of like powerful dashing slash. There is running, so it's not quite Zelda, but there is a very similar sort of top-down 2D Zelda vibe going on. The downside of that is because there's so many more enemies, because the game is more combat-focused, they respawn every time the camera shifts. And that's a real pain in the ass, because the number of hearts is limited, and the puzzles cause you to drop things if you get hit, and then you lose them. So you have to carry it without getting hit, and sometimes that's really hard when the enemies respawn.
Okay.
That does mean like some of the puzzles are, hey, there's a kill room here. Normally to get from point A where the key is to the key door in point B, the most direct line is through the kill room. How can you set up the stage so you can get around the kill room? Because you obviously can't carry the key in there if you're going to drop it as soon as you start fighting. But, you know, it's, besides that, it is a fun game. Like I said, it's very basic. It's very quick. It's a good portable experience. We talked about the Switch as a portable device. This is a great for like, I've got a few minutes to play kind of game. I'm enjoying it. It's $5. It's dirt cheap.
$5. Okay. I might be down for this.
Yeah. Like it's, yeah, like I said, I beat it in a little bit over an hour.
That's in Gunman Clive territory, which I think is a perfectly fine amount of game for what it costs.
Yeah. I mean, it is a cheap game, and it's fun. You know, it's not flawless. It's got some weirdness, but it controls well. It controls well. The puzzles are pretty clever. Like I said, my biggest complaint is just the enemies respawn too aggressively. Beyond that, you know, I had a lot of fun with it. I'll probably go through and play with the other characters just to see what they're like. It is, like I said, it's very Nintendo inspired, including the floating head with two floating hands boss making an appearance. That guy gets lots of work. Yeah, it's and it's the whole like rule of three boss fights. So yeah, this game takes heavy influence, but it works out and I really like it.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Definitely give it a look.
Kamiko.
Yep.
Kamiko.
And on that, it's good to do new business. We come back. Listener mail. Stay tuned. Back. It's listener mail. You can send us an email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com and then we may read it on this show. And we also, if we read it on the show, may answer it. We may do one and not the other. We all have our mistakes sometimes. But Johnny has the first email.
You're making me read this novel. Okay.
I could have made you read like a whole like suite of novels, but we just did the one.
Just get a sip of water here. Okay. Klex Yoshi writes, "Hey, RFN guys, I don't know if I should be even sending this email. I wanted to do this while it's fresh on my mind, and I want to let you guys know that I don't mean any harm nor foul by asking you folk about this. Actually, this is probably a better question for our fine site director and Mr. Ronigan. But given the extended tenures the lot of you have and the deep roots in the Planet GameCube mythos that John has, that maybe would be an appropriate question for the lot of you. Industry whistleblower and entertainer James Nicholas Stanton, better known as Jim Effin Sterling, son, dedicated his popular Monday show, The Jimquisition, to brash games and the shady practices of being an all-volunteer website that regularly does things like edit the reviewer's scores without consulting the reviewer first, and discrediting writers whenever they attempt to separate from brash in an attempt to keep writer's portfolio and thus the writer trapped within the organization.
And when brash, he says discrediting, he doesn't mean like throwing them under the bus. He means literally removing their credit.
Yeah, okay. Brash Games isn't actually what this email is about, though. Rather, towards the end of this episode, Jim proceeds to close out with the fact that payment via quote-unquote exposure is not an isolated thing, but rather he very clearly remembers that Destructoid would take on unpaid interns and takes the firm ground that this is uncool and that the industry of games media has evolved too much for people to get in the door, that writers should focus on bolstering their brand rather than that of the site they write for, and that they don't have to pay the volunteer writer game they don't have to play the volunteer writer game anymore. My thoughts immediately landed with the folk of Nintendo World Report at large, and I have no better rapport with Nintendo World Report staff than I have with you. I get the feeling you folks are a tight-knit
well,
family. I get the feeling you folks are a tight-knit family, even if individual arms of the organization, such as Justin Berube and John Rarden, seem to rarely interact with, say, the artist formerly known as the Famicast. Patreon and ad revenue go toward keeping the ship afloat rather than compensating the staff, so I know that this camaraderie that keeps the whole thing afloat. So my long-winded that was the preamble? Okay.
Well, no, it's fine. It's fine. It's like he's almost done.
All right. Whew. So after my long-winded preamble to all this, my question is as follows. Do you worry that rhetoric like Sterling's could get loud enough to convince some of the current NWR staff to move on to greener pastures? Do you guys worry that it's going to be harder and harder to get more writers to come to the site on a volunteer basis? Heck, how hard has it been to get fresh blood among the staff in recent years versus the halcyon days of Web 1.0?
I don't worry about it. I mean, Neil obviously would probably be
so
the best
Neil,
voice
Neil
on this,
actually
but...
Neil actually has a response to this question.
Because
Neil reads our emails because he is our overlord. That was only half a joke, by the way. He says Neil's comfortable with quote, very comfortable with the way NWR handles our staff and volunteers because we're not selling false hopes. If people want to go and try this full-time or professionally, I support them totally. And never in a million years would we change the review scores or remove their names from articles. He continued later, but as far as worrying about people leaving or becoming harder to find these days, I don't think that's really dramatically different. The game's changed a lot, but is evidenced by the fact that a lot of the staffers have been around for, in some cases, decades, certainly in Lindemann's case. We've been able to stick around. I can't guarantee we'll be around forever, but I'm doing my best to set the site up to not blow up and die a fiery death. He has a little bit in there where he talks about, you know, at one point he thought about he's going to do this full time. It's going to be his springboard. But that's a whole different, you know, mentality than what we do here. And we've got two former site directors on here, both of which who have probably yelled at me at some point or another for not doing the right stuff. But, we used to have this policy about like, oh, you have to submit this much content every week. And it doesn't work with the volunteer site. Realistically speaking, you have to be involved. Like, you can't just be on staff and then just like show up for E3. But
like us,
technically speaking, John, we contribute significant content to the site every week. In spite of it being sure. In spite of it being a bad idea.
Well, sure. As one of the people who kind of implemented content quotas, for lack of a better term, for a while, I'll just say in defense of that idea and the people who tried to do it, and I'm sure have tried to do it at a lot of sites similar to ours. The idea was to help people stay engaged, to give people a regular responsibility, because if you keep coming back to the site every day or at least three or four times a week with the mindset that, hey, I'm responsible for something, I need to show up and check out what's happening and make something appear on the front page, that is a way to keep people engaged. And when people are engaged and talking to each other and contributing to the site, they have a better experience as a staff member, and we have a better experience with them being a productive member of the staff.
And it's also part of being upfront either way as well, right? Like, if you don't want to contribute on to the site week to week, then just say so, and that's perfectly fine.
Right. Like, you don't
act like you do and then not do it.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to understand with a site like ours, when you join the staff, you don't sign anything. You don't meet anybody. If you have an interview, it may literally be a text chat or some tweets or an email. You know, like, it's incredibly informal, and there's a lot of trust that goes on there.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And when you're not participating, when you're not, you know, when you say, well, I'm going to do something, or I'm going to be responsible for this certain section, or I have a certain thing that I'm supposed to do once a week on Sunday night or something, and you don't do that three or four times in a row, then not only are you not really on the staff anyway, like, you've already kind of decided to not participate here, but also, you know, the thing that you said you would do is not getting done. So that's actually a negative impact on the rest of us and on the site itself, on the quality. It reflects poorly on us. So either you can be a fan and just read the site and enjoy it, or you can be a volunteer and actually contribute. But if you say you're going to do it, if you say you're going to be on the staff, you have to actually be active. So with volunteer, you really have to rely upon people's motivation, self-motivation, and appeal to whatever their objectives are in joining the site. And we started to ask people about that, you know, just to be upfront about it. Hey, why do you want to do this? Like, why do you want to work for free? Hard. Right. Like, you know, potentially for years, like a lot of us have. Why would you want to do that? And you try to figure out, are these people in it for the right reasons? Do they have the right expectations? Do they understand that? I mean, we used to hire people who actually didn't realize it was a volunteer thing, and then they would quit on the first day.
Right.
And yeah, that's fine. That. Like, that's my fault for not being clear with you, because I'm not trying to trick anybody here. You need to know we are doing this thing as basically our own charity because we think it's fun, you know? So, like, you have to be really into that to actually commit to it and do a good job. And we're looking for the people who have that drive.
And so my comment on quotas is more on that. Like, just saying, like, everyone will submit 3 articles to the site doesn't work because it is a volunteer thing. Like, everybody has different availabilities. Everybody likes to do different stuff. One of the things that and we've talked about it as a staff, you know, we've had meetings, we've had lots of meetings. One of the things that we often would talk about is, you know, the role of writing up news versus writing up original content. Because news isn't really original content in and of itself. News is reprocessing facts. Like, there, you don't want to try to create new ideas in news. That's not news anymore.
Yeah,
that's analysis.
I mean, we're rarely reporting in our news articles. Although sometimes we are. So if you usually don't read the news articles, I would just say during special events, you should probably read the news articles, because that's where our actual reporting goes, where we have somebody on the scene, or you have someone watching the video in Japanese and like translating it, or checking with someone else to figure, like, that is useful analysis.
Exactly.
That is original content. You should read
that. But just reprocessing a press release or whatever. Like,
and for the most part, we don't even really do that anymore. Right.
Right.
From what I can tell, that's
a consequence of these conversations, because we realize that the value isn't in, hey, we got a press release from NISA America, where they're like, hey, we're going to release this fucking bullshit 3DS game that nobody wants to release. Here it is.
Yeah.
As a great
random example,
awesome,
right, James? Random example.
Well, considering they sent us about 35 press releases a day, no, it's not. But what we do instead is produce the content you care about.
Exactly.
We are volunteers. Like, so if you want to write about the covers of video games, which is a stigma I picked up because I made fun of one bad cover, like, go nuts. Like, we would support that totally. Because
do your bad cover art podcast. I mean, knock yourself out. But if that's what you're willing to do, and if it seems like anybody gives a shit about it, then fine, do it. You know, I mean, a site like NWR, because it is volunteer nature and because it is basically a long-term commitment, it attracts a very certain kind of person. I mean, you have to be a little bit crazy to do a job like this for no pay. And we've gotten pretty good at holding on to those people. And I tell you, that's really the best part about doing it, is because just to be, if I can gush on my friends here, you know, for a little bit, to be working very closely and very, very hard with people who have that degree of passion, to see your passion reflected in them, and to have that kinship and this common interest that is so strong, is very inspiring. It makes it all more than worthwhile. But what we do is not for most people. So, you know, and I think we're pretty upfront with people. I think we've learned how to be very clear about that with people, and we've, you know, learned how to attract the people who actually do have what it takes, or rather they have, you know,
they have the psychosis that makes this possible.
That's what I was going for. Exactly. They have the kind of weird obsession that lets you be successful in this kind of endeavor.
And I mean, if people want to use this as a springboard, that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people out there that write professionally now that have worked on the site, and I think that's awesome. I still see, you know, because we have on the back end of the site, we have the names of every single person that has ever posted an article. And it's wild when
like guests, like people who were on the forum who put together an article, how to identify a bootleg DS game. We've got his name in here. He wrote one thing for us and we stole it from the forums.
Yeah. It's crazy when you see, you know, that person working for CNN or writing for IGN or something, and you can look and there they are. That's where they started, like NWR at some point when they were just starting out. They were writing articles for us way back in the day, back in 2001 or something.
Yeah.
So that's really cool.
One of the other things I would say to differentiate us from what Brash did, and this article doesn't really speak about it, but This is the, you may have seen going around, where on his way out, one of their reviewers basically turned his review into a commentary about Brash to see if it could get posted without being caught, which it did. and one of the things he talked about was the only person he ever talked to was another review writer for the site. He never got any feedback, and we have aggressive feedback at NWR.
You're welcome.
And sometimes aggressive is the right word. And like, one editor might go down another one's throat and go like, dude, no, that's too hard.
I had to tone my shit back a lot of times.
We have constant feedback, and
I got complaints about my feedback quite often, actually.
I've complained about people's feedback to other people. Like, I'm like, dude, that's too much. You need to take that down to like an 8. But like, even the podcast article, the most superfluous thing we do, the article about an audio file that you may not even read because you're subscribed to it.
Watch
gets
your mouth.
Edited.
I wrote about 300 or 400 of those, James.
I've written about 100 of them. I know what it's about.
Don't put it down, man.
You know as well as I do, there are times when you're writing thing going like, oh God, all right, what am I going to write? It's just, James had some fucking bullshit where you drop traps in a PS3 game. Great. All right. Whatever. it is by far the most superfluous part of the podcast, but it still gets edited. Somebody still sits there and reads it. Like, I still text John on Sunday going, John, the article's ready. And I get a response back. Oh God.
Well, yeah. when you have something like that, and that's a responsibility that I took over from Carl and
right.
When I became host of the show, I could have just been like, you know what? We're a podcast. We don't need these damn articles. I'm not even going to bother.
But they're still there.
I did it because at the time, certainly, I think this was true, it was a way to get new people to listen to the podcast.
Absolutely.
Having it up there all the time, making the articles interesting. This is back when people actually read our articles on a regular basis, you know, and that was the main feature of the site. So having an article about the podcast was free advertising for my new podcast, you know? Why wouldn't I do that? And yeah, it's like, it's something I kind of have to do every week on like late on Sunday night or even Monday morning before I go to school/work. And maybe it's not really what I would like to be doing, but I can look at it as a necessity and a tedious pile of garbage that I have to dig through every week. Or I can look at it as an opportunity to make insider jokes to my friends and to practice writing and to insert links and raise that, you know, hot search engine optimization score.
Oh, God.
For my articles and insert all the hey, if you go back to the articles that I wrote for RFN episodes, you'll see they are stacked sometimes 20 or 30 deep of cross-reference links on the sidebar, which I entered manually from drop-down lists.
Oh, I know. Believe me.
Many hours of my life doing that.
And every week it's the real joy.
Yeah, well, it's easier than doing searches through
it is easier now.
Yahoo search or whatever, and then like opening up 18 browsers and copying URLs out of those and then pasting that into your custom HTML code, which is how I used to do it for stuff like that.
I remember those days.
The cross-reference tool is from heaven above and also from Michael Cole. So
my point is that like it's the exact opposite situation. You know, we have
Brash Games, we're I think pretty much polar opposites.
We have like the feedback to me is the biggest deal, and that actually goes back to the internship conversation.
It's one of the main reasons that when I was recruiting people, the biggest carrot I had is like, look, come do this difficult work for me for free, but I can teach you to write.
Johnny's gonna make you buy the style guide.
Yeah.
Which one was it?
I will give you an online seminar course in how to edit.
It was Elements of Style 8, right? That was the version we were using?
Yeah, Strunk and White. It's one of the greatest books of all time.
I mean, I always liked it when Johnny would edit my stuff because I'm a good writer, so I like to see what – I'm like, here you go. Try to poke some holes in this, motherfucker. Go ahead. And he'd find something, I'd be like, ah, good point. You know? Like, it's interesting for me. You know?
I'm handing it off
to a guy that has a PhD, for crying out loud. Like, where are you going to get that? Right? So.
I used to really enjoy just, like, seeing stuff come back, like, clean and go, like, I did it. And then, like, immediately see something come back, like, somebody else picked it up, and they're like, these should all be semicolons, and then we just have this long going out, like, no, that's not how you use a semicolon, asshole, and it would just get weird and awkward, and beautiful. Like, the greatest example of this, my Mario Galaxy 2 review. Like, this is by far the most important review I ever wrote for the site.
Yeah, which you played through that entire game in, like, 48 hours or something, and then had to write the review for it. Jeez.
Yes, the embargo was Tuesday. I got it Saturday at like 6.
Let me just say this for the record. That is way more work than fun.
Oh yeah, it was awful.
Because like, I've been there before too, and it's exciting, but you look back and like, what a horrible way to play game.
I love that game, but I also kind of hate it as a result. Right. Like,
yeah, like you're done with it forever.
I wanted to finish that review super early so I could send it in to get edited. And like five people took cracks at it. And then we went live. And then like I got an email from another editor on the site. Well, why didn't you mention the Yoshi stuff in more detail? And I'm like, look, motherfucker.
Yoshi my and, ass.
Like, and then that caused like this weird like internal debate because we are engaged with each other. And it was like, dude, why didn't you call him out on it sooner? I don't think the Yoshi stuff's important. I'm just sitting there going, like, none of you fucks to play this game. And, like, I eventually just muted that entire email chain because I'm like, I can't deal with this. Yeah,
this stuff, it might seem contentious at times, but it all comes from a place of wanting to do the best job. The highest quality product out there on the site to do our readers the most justice and make sure that we ultimately are proud of what we do.
So. I mean, there's a reason I'm laughing about it because it is so ridiculous. Like there's this beautiful joy in like watching eight people who had nothing to do with the review that you wrote debating whether or not I gave enough time to the Yoshi segment of a game they haven't played. Yeah. And I'm just going like, none of you know how important this is. What are you doing? Yeah. And I was like, I can add another paragraph. No, it's not. Don't worry about it. It's just like,
it's like, look, don't make me feel bad. I'm gonna find you all and kill you. I have the time to do it.
It's like I played this game in like 37 hours. I don't want to hear it. But at the same time, we talk about what we got, and he mentions the site being a tight knit group, and to some degree, it is. But like, there are definitely like different, centers of the site staff,
there's clicks. There's clicks for sure.
Yeah,
mostly like, podcasts. I think we turned the clicks much. Into podcasts.
Yeah, there's definitely some like some exactly, Barry centers right. around the podcasts
because we have nine podcasts now. So
it is an absurd number of podcasts.
Everybody gets one, you know.
Seeing the Famicast guys when I was in Japan was really cool. I've had interactions with them in the past, but not like a all the time regular thing. I got to see Danny and I got to see Matt. And of course I talked to some of them while I was there because I recorded from our hotel room.
And see, James, I'm jealous because I feel like I've been friends with those guys for like on average like a decade. I've never met any of the Famicast guys in person except Ty Sugar.
That's true. Yes. I've met Ty, but not in Japan.
Yeah, and I haven't seen Ty in the last time I saw Ty, I hacked his blog crew into E3.
Yes. Yeah.
I hacked their credentials and got them E3 badges on site on the first day of the show.
Yeah, and so that led to me meeting Ty because I met him at the Natsume booth playing Gabriel's Ghostly Groove. Thank you, Johnny. Thank you for that.
That was the first time you met Ty?
Yes.
Oh, it's everyone remembers their first time.
But like I literally NWR is literally responsible for me actually leaving the country for the first time. Hmm. Quite literally. Like I met people and that dragged me out of here to become do international travel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It dragged me to LA and that's probably the right phrase to use for being sent to LA.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I went to E3
when
I went to E3 1999, that was the first time I'd ever actually been on a plane.
Jeez.
Yeah. I had no reason to travel by plane after that point. Like, there was just no reason for me because I'd never been out to the West Coast. So
yeah, well, certainly the first time I ever went to California, where I live now.
Yeah, I mean, like it is not unreasonable to say that being on this site, although I never launched my professional hot takes career, did dramatically alter some elements of my life.
Oh yeah, working on this website is life changing. Just regardless of good or bad. I mean, if you're part of the staff for more than a few months. You'll probably say, yeah, that was really cool. You got to do something amazing. And I think over the years, we've done a pretty good job at trying to involve everybody and find, they're volunteers. I mean, the only way to get people to continue to put out that kind of effort over the long term is to find what they're passionate about and harness it and let them, you know, everybody gets to fly their freak flag and do something really cool with their friends. And that's the opportunity that we provide. And along the way, you might learn something.
Oh yeah.
I don't claim that that's an equal trade for the time and effort you put in. That's not your payment. That's just all the bonus stuff. Your payment is you do it. You right. know,
your payment you get, is you're having an opportunity to put your, what you're passionate about out there.
Yeah. If that's not enough for you, then you're barking up the wrong tree with our site. Cause that's all you get, you know,
but at the same time, if that's not the case, then that's cool.
But that also, yeah, oh, totally. But, go although, and I think this is really key just to kind of circle back around to the email and what started all this. The really key thing is that's what all of us are in for it all the way right. to the very top. There's
yeah, Neil's not getting paid either.
No, no. If anything, Neil and Billy and everybody who's ever been involved in hosting this site and actually running it and making sure that the bills get paid and that the shirts get sold and that the money goes into a bank account somewhere, those people, I guarantee you, all of them, especially, you know, including myself, all of us who've been around a long time, we have spent so much money on this website, you cannot imagine. When I count up, you know, I've been to E3, what, 15 times?
Yeah.
You know, that's I could have bought a couple of cars for what I've spent on this website just in those trips alone. And so, like, it was E3s, an incredible value. I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I will say, to kind of wrap up my thoughts on it, before I want to touch on the internship thing real quick, because that's a larger industry conversation.
Oh, I don't even know if we should get it. That's like, as far as like developer interns and stuff, it's a.
Oh, no, yeah, I'm not talking developer interns. I'm just talking about
separate topic.
I'm talking about the line between a paid and unpaid intern. Because there's a bright line there.
With Brash, I mean, the big thing there is that they were obviously doing that to make money, right?
Right.
Which leads to a lot of potentially nefarious stuff.
An unpaid intern should be a student.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean they're in school. I mean, like, their responsibility in their internship should be to learn, not to deliver content.
Yeah, and I mean, and when you're putting somebody's content up there and putting their name on it and then stripping their name from it, that's just unethical.
Yeah.
There's just no two ways around it. It's just highly
very
unethical.
Disrespectful. I mean, once people find out that you're doing that, nobody's going to want to write for you. So it's suicidal as an organization.
Their site's now gone. So
that's why you don't do that shit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it goes around.
You be honest with people and you be respectful of them. And if they write one article and then decide it's not for them, you say, hey, thank you for trying and being honest with yourself, and I really appreciate it. And you've got this one article that will always be here with your name on it until this site is gone forever.
And you know what do you end that with? Stay in touch. Because maybe something changes.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not saying we're perfect and we never made mistakes with stuff like that, but I think, you know, the vast majority of people who have come and gone through our website would tell you that it was a great experience and they would recommend it. And
you've spoken to a few of them just recently. In your book endeavor.
Yeah, well, obviously I'm pretty passionate about this kind of stuff because I'm writing a book about it. And I think these are, if you're interested in these kinds of topics, there will be a lot of words about them one day that you can buy or whatever.
I will say the one moment where I realized all of this pays off, there's a couple actually. There was the first time we did the PAX panel and we're looking out and we're like, there are people here to see us talk. What the fuck are we doing?
There are people asking me for my autograph, which should never – that should never happen in any timeline.
There was the moment where I looked at John and said, John, we should have had a bottle of liquor up here.
Yeah.
And John's immediate response was, yeah, obviously. And I was like, yeah, well, that's pretty much where we're at.
A bottle of human breast milk.
Oh, God, no. But the other was I'm sitting in the middle of Tokyo in the Capcom bar, or as they called it, the Cap bar. Across from Danny Bivens, and in between us is a Monster Hunter themed plate that's on nachos on fire. and Carly is to my immediate right, and she's just laughing about the fact they set the sour cream on fire because she thinks it's the best. And I'm like, what the fuck did this site get me into?
Yeah, I mean, the site has evolved into something that I never could have predicted ever. I mean, no. just almost 20 years later, and I'm still kind of like, and you know, it's funny.
I was thinking about that earlier. Like, I'm coming up on 20 years. I'm a couple away, basically, from 20 years.
And what's really interesting to me is how we're now part of this connected web of Nintendo people that are all spread out over the globe. I mean, just think about, like, we find out about stuff immediately. It's like James, like, just getting a text from Sarin, hey, there's a 2DS XL. Like, we literally find that shit out, like, right away.
It's being announced right now. And I'm what do you mean it's being announced right now? And then she sends me a picture. I'm like, you're fucking kidding me.
It's just hilarious, man.
In the middle, there is a weird absurdness that's come out of being involved in this.
Yeah, and it's like, oh my god, who would care about this? James, John, Johnny, and Guillaume would care about this. And we're oh my god.
It's like, I know you're in the middle of the podcast, but I'm going to drop this on you and walk away. Have fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
God damn it. Okay, here we go.
Fun times. Yeah.
All right, let's move on to the next email, because we could do this one the entire segment.
That question was answered in such a long-ass fashion, I can't even remember
It's John. It's you. First time. Yes.
All right. MASB writes, greetings, Greg, Gee, and J&J, the men who know business. I know that RFN is used for tackling hard-hitting questions, like when the moon hits your eye like a big piece of pie. Is that really a moire or just an eye injury? Speaking of love that hurts, let's talk about the NES Classic MIDI. I've heard many theories about its discontinuation. One, they had to cancel it so they could focus on making the Switch. My question, are they even made at the same factory? Number two, third-party game licensing ran out. My thought, they have the contract structured so that they can last the life of the system on Virtual Console, but not the NES Mini. Number three, the pirates broke open the system. My thought, couldn't they had simply fixed the flaw for the new systems? Now there are rumors of a Super NES Mini. Will Nintendo take the same tack, not gauge demand via pre-orders and make too few units? Or will they say, we could have sold so many NES Minis, so we'll make 10 million of a different product and wonder why it's not selling as fast? Regards. P.S. I've never seen an NES Mini in stores.
I saw one in Japan at like a 900% markup.
I've never seen one. I haven't really looked either.
And I'm not 100% convinced that it wasn't actually – so the store sells new and used. I'm not 100% convinced they didn't just open one of their new stock and then say it was used and increase the markup by 900%.
Oh, my gosh. That's very illegal, but I'm sure it happens a lot.
Yeah. Or they sell it to a staff member who immediately sells it back to them or some bullshit like that.
Yeah, I don't know about that. We can theorize a lot on why Nintendo did this. I think the classic Nintendo part of it is that they didn't even try to explain it.
Right.
This is our call. This is what we're doing. We're just letting you know, which you should be grateful that we're even bothering to tell you that we're discontinuing it, and go off and wonder why. We don't care. It's their deal, and I don't know why. It's just part of their culture. I suspect oftentimes the answers are a lot simpler than people make them out to be. But in this case, I think it's probably they're moving on to a similar but new product, whether that's just the NES Mini 2 with different games on it because the licenses ran out, or just because they wanted to refresh it, or it's got it fixes the hacking and stuff that you can do to it. Or maybe it's, hey, we want to make the Super Nintendo or the Game Boy version of this, but it would be made at the same factory and we can't really manufacture both at the same time. So we'll do this other one and then maybe we'll bring back the NES Mini later if we still think there's demand. But I just think it ultimately comes down to they're not good at communicating this kind of announcement. And also I don't think they really care. I think they're fine for people to just be mystified by it. It increases the hype and the desirability of the thing. And it'll probably give them even better headlines when they announce its successor.
So I will say that they mentioned it during their investor stuff, which just happened today. But they mentioned it in such like passing that it's kind of fascinating. Like, they didn't really touch on the shortages. They didn't really touch on why they've discontinued it. It just sort of mentioned that it was a thing that they sold. And to me, that speaks everything. They probably said, we're going to make this stuff for holiday. We're going to sell this many of them, and that's it. And the idea that there was a shortage never really occurred to them. It's just like, oh, we sold them all. That's how many we were going to make. And now they have been sold.
Yeah, it's like that was our intent. We always wanted this to be only a certain set run, and that's it. They're all gone.
I don't think they're that obtuse. I mean, if it was meant to be a limited edition thing, they would have labeled it that way. They're not above doing so.
See, I always just viewed it as like this is our holiday stopgap because there's not much coming out this year.
Well, that was the main reason for it to exist, certainly. But in terms of their response to its popularity, I think they decided for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, maybe it had low profit margins or it was, you know, relatively difficult to manufacture, you know, or whatever the case may be, I think it's just the kind of product where it became much more popular than they predicted. For some reason, they didn't seem to understand or anticipate that. And then when it did become that popular, they couldn't find a way to capitalize on that. And so the product became more trouble than it was worth. It's like everybody wants it. Everyone's complaining about this or that, and they can't find one, and it's too expensive. And we're over here making $2 a pop selling it. It's not even worth the trouble. Like we obviously have something here that we need to capitalize on, but we're going to have to go back and make a new product with some lessons learned. And then come back out and be like, hey, I know you've been waiting to get your hands on one of these. Check this out instead. It's even better. That's what Nintendo does. That's what they're going to do. But it's infuriating to be on the outside looking in and be like, what? Because they don't even try to help you understand what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that's why our podcast exists, by the way. So thanks, Nintendo.
One of the things that's always really fun about dealing with Nintendo, we talk about what you learn from doing this show or doing this website, is you can ask them the most straightforward question and not get any answer whatsoever.
Yep.
You may get an answer that basically reads, we're not talking about this right now, and that's probably the most accurate answer you will get because it is true. They are literally not talking about this right now. End of the question answers. It's like, oh, okay. Thank you. I would expect that somebody during the Q&A asked about it. The Q&A hasn't come out yet, the slides. They released a presentation already. They released, of course, their briefing yesterday. I would expect some investor somewhere asked about it because this was an issue in Japan as well. But again, even if they did, the answer is probably going to be something like, well, we anticipated sales of X number. And that's the amount we provided. We were caught by surprise by the sales numbers. But you know, we discontinued that product in line with our plans for the year. Something along those lines. I mean, they probably always intended to stop making it around now. And it's just like, oh, it's also really stupid that no one was able to get one who wanted one. So
it all goes back to the scarf, James. The Zelda scarf.
No, it doesn't.
It does. The longer I do this podcast, the more it becomes the more that becomes a watershed moment in Nintendo culture. It explains so much.
Amiibos, Mini, scarf, they're all the same story.
That's the whole thing. All of this is driving to this podcast, NWR, everything.
Look,
it's just
the fact that
it doesn't mean anything.
Like, I don't think Nintendo is trying to fuck with us, but if they were, they would do the same things that they're already doing.
Oh, so here is how much they talked about the NES Classic Edition in their financial briefing. You will love this. Nintendo Entertainment System, NES Classic Edition, also launched in Japan and overseas in November to widespread popularity. Although the release of some new titles offering Amiibo functionality restored some momentum, end of conversation about the NES Classic. Here is a whole fucking paragraph about Amiibo.
Well, at least they acknowledged that it was popular. That's good.
But all of that is under the Nintendo Entertainment System bullet.
By the way, there's a number of things I would probably change about the NES Mini. I did get to spend some time with it, but I got to say, I bought one for my niece and nephews, and they love it, and they've been playing it a lot. Their mom and dad both, you know, are my age, basically, so grew up with NES, and they know the games, and they're playing them with the kids, and the kids are loving it. I mean, this is their first video games with controllers. So, which is fun because that was also my first video game with a controller, you know, like they're having a very similar experience to when we were kids and growing up with NES. And
it's two buttons. It's not like a,
yeah,
I mean,
it's easy. I mean, yeah, 3-year-olds can play it, you know, and, yeah. And they're having a blast. And now, you know, I call my sister and she's in the car and my nephew's screaming at me about how do you get to the princess in Mario? And it's exciting. Like that's honestly what I was hoping would happen when I bought them this thing.
Did you tell him get good? Because you should have.
Oh, I'm going to have to break it to him when I see him in person next time. Look, buddy, you're going to have to get good. And it's,
I know you think you've seen this level before, but keep going.
Yeah. I can't beat them for you, you know.
Hey, when you're done with that, why don't you play Super Mario 3 on this 3DS? Make note of the D-pad, little man.
This one will make a man out of you.
We actually got a lot of emails about the NES Classic being discontinued. Not surprising.
Well, it's bizarre. You know,
it is bizarre. The Super Nintendo Classic. The Super Nintendo Classic is even more confounding because that's got less resonance than the NES.
Whatever. I will buy that in a heartbeat. Now one's gonna be Uncle's. Okay, that one's gonna stay with me. I mean, playing Chrono Trigger and you know, Mario World and everything else on it.
I think I would only get it if it had Star Fox or Yoshi's Island.
Those would be fantastic. Yes, they should do that.
I would assume, though, that the Switch Virtual Console is probably going to end up looking a lot like the one that's on this in terms of, like, features and stuff. Because these are actually really good Virtual Console ports compared to the Wii U ones.
The emulation's excellent.
So I would assume that this probably is going to be the same emulation tech that ends up on Switch.
God, I hope so.
But, like, what we know about the Switch Virtual Console can be written on the back of a postage stamp. Like, it ain't much.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced they'll do it. But I certainly hope they do. And if they could, you know, let you group up your games in kind of a similar way to the interface for the NES Mini, where you get this special theme song that's done in the style of that system, and the games, you get the, you know, you get the title screen and some box art, and you can push a button and read interesting facts about it. That's the way this should be. It should feel like you're in a game, even when you're browsing through the games and deciding what to do. I wish my Virtual Console stuff had that kind of functionality now. It'd be amazing. It's a great package. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll see where they take this. I do wonder if it was just a marketing thing. Not the shortages, but just like, hey, getting like a redux of what they did with Pokemon earlier in the year, where it's like, we're putting Pokemon out there. We're really pushing the old Pokemon to try to get that nostalgia train going. But, I mean, the shortages were not intentional. Anybody who's selling you the idea of artificial shortages is a lunatic. Yeah. Why would you want to not be able to sell someone product?
There's lots of ways for Nintendo to screw up this kind of situation without resorting to complete and utter, you know, anti-economic buffoonery. Exactly. They're not creating shortages. Shortages happen. And then you, as the company selling the product that's in short supply, have several different ways you could go with how to respond to that. And Nintendo, being the way they are, is usually going to go for the way that seems the cheapest. So
Apparently, that meant discontinuing it this time.
Yeah,
I would guess we have not seen
the last of this kind of product. I mean, rest assured.
I would guess what happened is they probably showed it to retailers who had seen lots of these things from Sega and Atari and fucking Intellivision. There was a ColecoVision one at one point. And they're like, oh, yeah, whatever, plug-and-play TV consoles, who cares? And so, I mean, when you have a product like this, you show it to retailers early, and they tell you how many they want, and that's how many you make.
And just think how things would be different if they had showed that thing at E3 last year.
Right. Because then
they would have made 10 million of them, and you'd be able to walk in and buy a used NES Mini at you know, the rundown Blockbuster. So, I mean, this just, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it was almost certainly they showed it to retailers who were not impressed by the idea of a plug-and-play console because they've seen hundreds of them.
Sure.
And the retailers didn't get that, like, hey, a Sega Master System plug-and-play console that kind of sort of works. It plugs into your RGB cables on your friggin' TV. Not the same as this thing. But the people who were interested sure saw the difference, and that disconnect is going to happen sometimes.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll see the Super NES Mini at E3, and they'll get a pretty good idea of how bad people want it. and then they'll make enough of them.
Jason, who wants us to plug him as his control alt the his control alt delete to control alt del tutorials on YouTube. It's AULT. Writes, hello RFN crew. You asked for emails, and I know how much you all love Amiibos. Love. I, like many others, jumped on the Amiibo hype train. A one-way ticket to waiting in line with the worst kinds of gamers on Earth, where you stand in shame, wondering how you let yourself get to this point. Now that I have way too many Amiibos, and also now that Disney Infinity has come to an end, I would like to see Nintendo make a game dedicated to Amiibos. I myself would be happy to have a game set in the style of Disney Infinity, but using every Amiibo that is released and building parts and tools themed to Nintendo, Capcom, Sega, and Yacht Club games. This is my idea, Amiibo Infinity.
This is my nightmare.
It is not the best idea, but at least it's more than what currently exists. I'd like to hear you guys come up with what would finally make Amiibos worth getting. Thanks for the great show.
That whole email is like a pretty much literal description of my personal hell.
So desperate.
The best part is in the email chain, I immediately jumped. We talked about like editing track. I immediately jumped on the email going like, no, it's Amiibo, singular, in all cases, lowercase a, sir. And then yeah. I was like, oh, wait, never mind. Also, fuck Nintendo style guys. They're the worst.
What would make Amiibo worth?
What would make Amiibo worth getting, John? How many Amiibo do you have?
I have a single Amiibo. It is the Mario pixel one.
Okay.
So.
Am I going to have the most Amiibos? James?
You're like.
Am I
going
to have the most Amiibo? I have two.
Okay. Well, I have way more than that. Unfortunately. Okay.
Oh, thank God.
I'm sorry. I've got Pixel Mario, Toad, Luigi, but the bad one, the one where he's like standing in a column of his own piss.
They're all the bad ones.
Yeah, well, oh, you know.
From the Piss Amiibo series.
Yes.
The title,
and yeah, you know, a Yoshi, a knit Yoshi, because of course, and probably have one. Oh, Chibi Robo.
Yep.
And yeah, that's probably it. That's enough. And I've used them to make it rain like meat from the sky in Breath of the Wild. But other than that, the best thing about Amiibos is that they're not
radioactive.
Well, yes. What's those? Not Zippo. What are they called? Funko Pop.
Yeah, they're not. They don't look like Funko Pop. They're not. They're not.
The best
just...
thing. The best thing about Amiibos is that they're not Funko Pop figures. You know, they're usually they look like the thing that they're supposed to be, and they're doesn't look like it's like some sort of creature.
Soulless, hellish nightmare.
You know, the good thing about heart attacks is that they're not cancer.
No, I mean Amiibo are good action figures. They're high quality action. There were some questionable ones in the first
figures.
Run of Smash Brothers, but since then, I think the design and the quality have been really good.
Yeah, I mean, the problem was Sakurai wanted his Amiibo to look like his statues in Smash Brothers, which aren't bound by the rules of physics.
Exactly, yeah.
I have two. I have Mega Man, which I bought because it's the only Mega Man product that will come out for the next decade. And I got a Yarn Yoshi with Yoshi's Woolly World.
I still want that one.
I
want the big one. I should clarify.
Well, yeah, the big one. See, the big one is where I figured Amiibo were going. Like, hey, we're gonna put the token in stuff.
Give me I want the Amiibo teddy bear, please. Or a big dog, like a big golden retriever Amiibo. Something I can hug on. You know,
it's a big golden retriever, but it's an Amiibo.
That's an Amiibo I have use for. But I'll take the Mega Yarn Yoshi if I can ever find one.
But we talk about Nintendo not putting stuff back into production. So the Link Amiibo from Smash Brothers gets you Epona in Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, that's good.
You would think they would say, oh man, that's going to crank the demand for this Amiibo up again, and we should make more of them. No, we didn't. So that Amiibo is now worth a stupid amount of money because people want that goddamn horse.
Well, that's fun, though. I like that. I kind of like that they're...
Maybe just make another round of them.
But James, they're making amiibo millionaires out there. Maybe you could be holding on to the one amiibo
Are you going to beanie baby me here?
Yeah.
Are we going to have to make like made in our home studio VHS tapes about how to tell real amiibo from fake ones?
Hey James, all I'm saying is me and my one amiibro, as I like to call him, Waluigi.
Jesus.
We're gonna get rich one day, or I should say, I'm gonna get rich because he's gonna go live with someone else out on a farm, and I don't
care. One will ever buy your Waluigi amiibo.
We'll see about that. By the way, I just want to clarify, when they're activated, as in when they're tapped by the on the amiibo sensor, amiibo are technically radioactive.
It's true. But I was thinking more like uranium.
Oh,
just
yeah.
They're
electromagnetically radioactive.
Yeah, dangerous to have in your home. I think that would really be the next step for amiibo. They're just coated in lead paint, and as that paint deteriorates, A, you are not consuming lead paint, and B, the radiation starts to seep out. It'd be a really nice, like, two-for-one feature of the product. Hmm. In terms of making the amiibo game, they already did. It's the Animal Crossing one on Wii U. The game that you can't play without amiibo.
Yeah,
I do think
they will try again, but it won't be anything like that.
No, I mean that game, they took Mario Party and made it worse, and then made it mandatory amiibo. That's an amazing product of just sheer hate.
No, I'm sure it was thrown together in about 3 months by the fresh outs at Nintendo.
Somebody get ND Cube on the phone. They've got 2 weeks to make me an Animal Crossing game.
Yeah, that's kind of what it smelled like to me. Is, oh, you felt like you needed this product, but you forgot to make it until the last minute. Okay, I see. Thanks. Nobody should have been surprised that that game tanked like it did.
Oh yeah.
But I do think they will do. I mean, you think about on Switch, there's almost nothing that you can do with amiibos except make meat fall from the sky or maybe summon a horse. So at some point, they're probably going to be putting stuff on the Switch that can access the full range of amiibo product line. I'm sure at some point there'll be something like, and I mean, Mario Kart will be a start, I suppose.
Yeah, and of course, Splatoon has amiibo functionality.
I would
like to see what the first Animal Crossing does, because they've been pumping out these Animal Crossing amiibo cards. In fact, when I was in Japan, like, stores had their own special amiibo card. Like, this is the 7-Eleven amiibo card you can only get here to get a friggin' 7-Eleven in your Animal Crossing village.
Mm-hmm.
I have to imagine that, like, those will all get moved up at some point, and that's where the dark cycle begins again. Because that was the other amiibo game. It was the Happy Home Designer, which they eventually just put into Animal Crossing, whatever the 3DS game was called.
Oh, did they just patch it in as like a bonus feature?
Basically.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Which if you bought Happy Home Designer, must make you feel like a real putz. But there is a weird kind of amiiboism going on in the Animal Crossing franchise that seems almost unique there. I would assume at some point we're going to get flooded with some, like, here's the next Fire Emblem on Switch. You're going to need to get your Ike amiibo out from 4 years ago if you want to access this special stuff. And then those are going to be worth $1 million on eBay. So get them now, kids.
You know, I'm not a big Animal Crossing fan, but that video of the guy in the dog suit playing guitar at a campfire.
Strangest video.
That brought me more pleasure than any Animal Crossing game ever could. So I'm thankful.
Like, that is by far the weirdest video Nintendo has ever produced for a Nintendo Direct. And that's a high bar to set. And that blew it out of the water.
Yeah, that was... I loved it. I would like to see more of that Nintendo.
I mean, you can go watch the Japanese one for Miitomo. That one's pretty bizarre.
I did watch the Shinran Kagura...
That one's pretty bizarre too. That's a different level of bizarre.
Boy.
No,
I can't believe that was on a Nintendo Direct. I mean,
the Miitomo one is like a 20-minute sitcom where this pretty dude in a library narrates this woman's life.
Yeah, I can't.
It's bizarre. It's truly strange.
I can't. Miitomo and Miitopia are just a bridge too far. Like, that's the side
It was Miitopia. Yeah,
all of the above. Like, I just, that's the side of Nintendo that's like, it's so far away from even being like playing a fun game, and it's so ridiculous that I can't even connect with it anymore.
Oh, it's special. I actually, you know what? I want an all Amiibo game where you make Nintendo Directs. Think about that. You just mix and match, and then it puts the scenes together.
It's called Nintendo Direct Talent Maker.
Done. Like, make it happen. Like, you know what? You build the scenes. You use your Amiibo to put characters into the scenes. They pantomime it out. It's done.
It'd have to be on 3DS because the Switch doesn't have a camera.
Oh, no, you don't have to pantomime it out. It pantomimes it out just based on like in the movies, that game for the PC where you would like pick the pantomime action of the characters.
Yeah, well, that game in the movies was, I think, very much inspired by Talent Maker. The was 64DD game. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So just stuff. Put that out there. You can use your Amiibo to make your Nintendo Direct, and you can have Reggie dressed as I don't know Pit from Kid Icarus.
As long as I can share the videos online, I could go for that.
There you go. You share videos online of just nightmares. Just make your own nightmares. It'll be great. And on that, it's gonna do it for new business or for listener. God damn it! That's gonna do it for listener mail this week.
James, I think you would have a lot of subscribers to your nightmare channel.
You can send us your nightmares to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we'll air them on the show for all to hear. Johnny, thank you for being on this week.
That was my great pleasure. Thank you for listening to me.
It is fun. It's fun to have you on.
Just to be blunt.
Is there anything you would like to plug, sir?
Yeah. The one podcast I still do with any kind of regularity is Box Office Poison. And I've been telling you guys for years, you should listen to it because it's a lot like this show, but about movies and probably a little looser. And it's super fun.
Looser than this?
Trust me, at times, yes. So, you should check out Box Office Poison. It's over on the Crosstalk Network, but you can search for either one, and you'll find them. And those guys are about to come visit me in L.A., and we're going to do our annual CrossCon weekend where we record like 3 or 4 podcasts and get drunk and go all over the city and do weird stuff, and it's going to be really fun. So, there'll be lots of good material coming out of that. I don't know exactly what we're going to do, but it'll be a good time. So if you like podcasts, you should check out Crosstalk because they make a lot of them.
That's a strong sell. All right. And on that, Greg, what's our music this week? Oh, he's not here. All right. So this week, our music is from Trauma Team, which came up in part because I'm playing Persona and it has the same artist. This song is The Dead Shall Speak. And on that, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Au revoir.
Bye-bye.